Last week we looked at the Ark, and before leaving it, I would like to look at its history. But I can't look at it in detail, and that would take us too long. In Exodus 25 and 8 you read this, "Let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them." But the Ark was especially God's dwelling place. Several verses in the Old Testament say that God dwelt between the cherubim. For example, Psalm 80 and 1 says this, "Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, thou that leadest Joseph like a flock, thou that dwellest between the cherubim, shine forth." In Numbers 2:17, you read that the tabernacle was in the center of the camp. That was its normal position. The Lord dwelt in the midst of the people, and you can compare that to the church. The Lord is in the midst of his people. And in Numbers chapter 10, verses 33 to 36, you read this, "They departed from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them in the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was upon them by day when they went out of the camp." So there were two signs of God's presence, the cloud above and the ark beneath. And then it goes on to say, "It came to pass, when the ark set forward, that Moses said, Rise up, Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee. And when it rested, he said, Return, O Lord, unto the many thousands of Israel." Those prayers in verses 35 and 36 may have been used morning and evening on their march, but they would be especially suited when the ark went before the armies of Israel and when they returned victorious. Then in Joshua chapter 3 we find that the ark was carried in front by the priests as they went down into and came up out of the Jordan. A picture of what we have in Romans 6. Believers dead, buried, and risen with Christ. Then in Joshua 6 you have that familiar story. For 6 days the ark was carried around Jericho, and the seventh day it was carried around 7 times. The men of war went first, followed by the priests with the trumpet, and then the ark, and finally the rear guard. A strange way to besiege a city. What was to prevent the inhabitants from rushing out and attacking them? But their faith was in God's presence in the ark. And so we're told that by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled 7 days. In 1 Samuel, we have a sad story. In chapter 3, the ark is in the tabernacle. In chapter 4, the people are defeated. Defeated before their enemies. So they bring the ark from Shiloh. They regarded it as a magic charm. And surely we will defeat the enemy now. But no, they were defeated again, and worse than before, because they were trusting in the ark of God instead of the God of the ark. And God allowed them to be defeated because of their sinful condition. The ark was taken, and a child was born called Ichabod, meaning, where is the glory? For the glory had departed from Israel. As an important lesson, correct church order can never be a substitute for godly living. One of the saddest verses in the Bible is Revelation 11 and 8, where Jerusalem is described. Jerusalem, the holy city, the city where God placed his name. And how is it described? It's described as the great city which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. A good position can never make up for a bad condition. The ark never returned to the tabernacle. It had no rest till Solomon built the temple. In 1 Samuel 5, it was set up in the house of Dagon, chief god of the Philistines, in Ashdod. But in the morning, Dagon was fallen on his face before the ark of the Lord. And so he was set up again. But the next morning he was fallen down again. his head, and the palms of his hands were broken off. Such was the power of the presence of the Lord. Then we're told that the hand of the Lord was against the people of Ashdod, for the presence of the Lord can bring judgment as well as blessing. Our God, we're told, is a consuming fire. The ark was then taken to Ekron, and for 7 months it was in the land of the Philistines, as we read in 1 Samuel chapter 5 and 6. After that it was taken to Kirjath-Jearim, and it was there for 20 years in the house of Abinadab, 1 Samuel 7. And we're told that Abinadab set apart his son Eliezer to keep the ark. A German expositor commented like this: "This Eliezer was constituted not priest, but watchman of the grave of the ark till the future joyful resurrection." Then in 2 Samuel chapter 6, you find David bringing up the ark. They place it on a new cart. In 1 Samuel 6, the Philistines carried it on a new cart. They knew no better, but David should have known better. It had to be carried on the shoulders of the Levites. And we're told that the oxen stumbled, and Uzzah put forth his hand to hold the ark. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and he smote him because he put his hand to the ark. We should notice that it does not say that he was smitten for driving a cart with the ark in it. His brother Ahio also did that, and he wasn't smitten. And it was David who was really responsible for putting it in the cart, and he wasn't punished. No, it says that the Lord smote him because he put his hand to the ark. Or as it says in 2 Samuel 6 and 7, for his error. Or as the NIV says, because of his irreverent act. Of course, if it had been carried by the Levites, it may not have happened. But the point emphasized is not the disobedience of David, but the sacredness of the ark. As we noticed, the poles were kept in it, so that it need not be touched. It reminds me of an incident in 1 Samuel 6, where the men of Beth Shemesh looked into the ark, and the Lord smote 50,000 and 70 of them. At least that is how the authorized version puts it. But it is generally agreed that the proper reading is simply 70. Such was the sacredness of the ark. After that incident, David was angry and afraid to take the ark to Jerusalem. And so he took it aside into the house of Obed-Edom. And the ark remained in the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. And the lesson is plain: the Lord's presence with his people brings blessing. But when David heard of the blessing the Lord brought to Obed-Edom, he went and brought up the ark to the city of David with gladness. But this time, according to 1 Chronicles 15:2, he recognized that only the Levites should carry the ark. Perhaps some of the priests had reminded him of that. It was placed in the temple by Solomon, 1 Kings 8, and the ark was not heard of after the Babylonian captivity. The New Bible Dictionary says it was presumably lost during the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BC. There was no ark in the second temple, according to Josephus. In the apocryphal book of Maccabees, there's a legend that Jeremiah took the ark, along with the tent of meeting and the incense altar, and hid it in a cave on Mount Nebo. It was to remain hidden until God finally gathers his people together and shows mercy to them. But that's only a legend. Jeremiah himself, looking to the future, says in chapter 3, verse 16, "It shall come to pass, when ye be multiplied and increased in the land, in those days, saith the Lord, they shall say no more the ark of the covenant of the Lord, neither shall it come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they visit it, neither shall that be done any more." The Zondervan Bible Dictionary says that after the destruction of the first temple, there is no evidence as to what happened to the ark, but only highly speculative tradition and conjecture. By the first temple is meant the temple built under Zerubbabel after they returned from Babylon, and that temple lasted almost 500 years, longer than the temple of Solomon or the temple of Herod, although we don't really read or hear much about it. There's a reference to the ark in Revelation 11 and verse 19. It says this, "And the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his testament, and there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and great hail." But that is not the literal ark of the tabernacle, but the divine original in heaven. We learn from Hebrews 8 and 5 that the tabernacle was a copy of things in heaven. And just as the ark in the ancient tabernacle symbolized God's presence with his people, so the appearance of the ark in heaven shows that God will again be with his people in the future and fulfill his promises to them. And notice too that it says that the ark was seen in the temple in heaven. In the Old Testament there was a veil in between, but the veil is removed and the ark is seen in the heavenly temple. Let us now come to the holy place. In the holy place there were three vessels or pieces of furniture: the table of showbread, the lampstand, and the altar of incense. The word showbread, which is found in the Authorized Version at verse 30, is really misleading. It is literally bread of the presence, and it is so translated in the NIV. Dr. Edersheim, who is a great authority on things Jewish, wrote that the presence bread meant that the covenant people own God's presence as their bread and their life. The lampstand meant that he was the source of their light, and God's life and light come to us as we are found in fellowship with him in prayer, as symbolized by the golden altar. In brief, the table teaches us that God is our food, the lampstand that God is our light, the altar that God is the source of our fellowship. Now, I think that expresses well the primary meaning. On the other hand, C.H. McIntosh applied the three to Christ. Christ is our food, is our light, is our intercessor. A Jew, of course, would not have understood it that way, but it is surely a proper application for the Christian. For many things said of God in the Old Testament are said of Christ in the New. But then Alexander McLaren, who was a great expositor, said that the presence bread was an offering of Israel's activities and its results to God. And the lamp showed that they were intended as a light for the world. The altar showed that their life was one of continual devotion. Well, I think we can take the three of them. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all, 1 John 1:5. I am the light of the world, John 9:5. And you are the light of the world, Matthew 5:14. Well then, let us look at the table. Shall we read from Exodus chapter 25, and first of all verses 23 to 28. You shall also make a table of acacia wood, and 2 cubits shall be its length, 1 cubit its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold, and make a moulding of gold all around. You shall make for it a frame of a hand's breadth all around, and you shall make a gold moulding for the frame all around. And you shall make for it 4 rings of gold, and put the rings on the 4 corners that are at its 4 legs. The rings shall be close to the frame, as holders for the poles to bear the table. And you shall make the poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold, that the table may be carried with them. You notice similarities to the ark. It was of acacia wood, overlaid with gold, goal, speaking of divine glory. However, it was smaller than the ark. The ark was 2.5 cubits by 1.5 by 1.5, as we have in verse 10, but the table was 2 by 1 by 1.5. It had the same height, but it was less in breadth and length. And also it had a gold moulding, and then there were the rings and the poles to carry it. It doesn't say, however, that they could not be taken out. It was less sacred than the ark. Then in verse 29, you read of the dishes or plates. They would be for carrying the loaves or cakes. And then the pans or ladles, which would be for the incense, and the pitchers and bowls for the drink offering, because a drink offering accompanied all meal offerings. And then, as I've mentioned in verse 30, you read of the showbread, or the bread of the presence. Some think that expression, bread of the presence, means simply that it was laid out in the presence of God. Others, however, believe that it means more than that. As we have seen, Edesheim thought that it meant that God's presence was their bread and their life. And notice the words, before me always. The last words of verse 30. You shall set the showbread on the table before me always. We must now look at Leviticus chapter 24, verses 5 to 9. That's an important passage concerning the showbread. Leviticus 24, verses 5 to 9. And you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them in 2 rows, 6 in a row, on a pure table before the Lord. And you shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be on the bread for a memorial, an offering made by fire to the Lord. Every Sabbath, he that is Aaron shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him from the offerings of the Lord made by fire, by a perpetual statute. Now, verse 5 says, you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. Now, the Good News Bible gives 12 kilograms for the total weight, and that would make 1 kilo for each. Some versions say loaves, or others say cakes. So what you have here is really a meal offering, similar to what you have in Leviticus chapter 2. Now, the meal offering was primarily the consecration of the offerer's daily labor and food to the Lord. Now, as I've said, this is similar to what you have in chapter 2, but there are differences between chapter 2 and chapter 24. First of all, chapter 2 is individual. The individual brought his meal offering. But chapter 24 is for the nation. And chapter 2 was voluntary. The person brought it when he thought fit. And chapter 24 is compulsory. Chapter 2 was repeated from time to time, but chapter 24 was continual. You remember the last expression in Exodus 25? On the table before me, always. At times a brazen altar might have no portion of a meal offering upon it, but the table always had the meal offering. Now, primarily, it is the nation of Israel making an offering, but the perfect fulfillment is only seen in the perfect Israelite. And then verse 6 speaks about 2 rows. Some say 2 piles. The word means an arrangement or order. Now, I can't speak with authority on this point, but to me a row seems more fitting. It would be more fitting that the eye of God should rest on each tribe separately, just as they were separate on the high priest's garments. rather than all lumped together. Verse 7 speaks of pure frankincense on each row. Now, frankincense is a symbol of prayer and praise. Psalm 141 and 2 says this, "Let my prayer be set before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice." And it was to be for a memorial. It was like a prayer. Lord, remember me. Lord, remember us. Verse 8 tells us that it was to be changed every Sabbath. And verse 9, that it was eaten by Aaron and his sons. Now, in Matthew chapter 12, our Lord made two important references to the showbread, and he taught an important lesson. So let us turn to Matthew chapter 12. Now, first of all, I will read verses 1 and 2. At that time, Jesus went through the cornfields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, and began to pluck ears of corn and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." They said in effect that they were breaking the fourth commandment, which said that no work was to be done on the Sabbath. Now the Lord could have said, "That's not work. Plucking some ears of corn is not work. That's no violation of the command." But he virtually accepted the charge of a technical breach of the commandment. And he referred to an incident that took place in 1 Samuel 21. Now let me read verses 3 and 4. "Then he said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests.'" And the lesson is, in ceremonial matters, God's strict order may be modified in special circumstances. Another noteworthy example of that is in 2 Chronicles 30 and 18, where the people were allowed to eat the Passover contrary to what was written in the law because of the special circumstances. All Israel had come to Jerusalem to observe the Passover, and the expression of the unity of Israel was more important than strict ceremonial observance. The second reference to the showbread is in verse 5. "Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless?" And that refers to the changing of the showbread, as we read in Leviticus chapter 24 and verse 8. And so the law was waived for the service of God. And then in verse 11, the Lord said that the Pharisees were not consistent themselves. Let me read verse 11. "Then he said to them, 'What man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out?'" That certainly would involve work, but because of the special circumstances, the strict law concerning no work on the Sabbath was modified. And then in verse 7, the Lord said, "If you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless." In other words, loving kindness is more important than correct ceremonial observance. Mr. Harold Sinzin once remarked that where there's a conflict between two of God's laws, that must prevail which is closer to his heart. And the law of love is closer to God's heart than any ceremonial law.